WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, I'm Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer. The war in the Democratic Republic of Congo is once again flaring up and making headlines. The M23 rebels left Goma on Saturday after taking the North Kivu province city of a million people on November 20th. It's just the latest turn in a war that's been going on basically since 1996. It has claimed 5 million lives. Did you know that in terms of how bloody it was? To explain who the M23 rebels are, what they want, and who supports them is Jason Stearns, the author of the book Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo, and The Great War of Africa. The widely read blog, you might not know this, but I have it on authority that everyone in Congo reads, Congo Siasa. He joins us from Bukavu, just south of Goma. Welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Thank you.
Okay. Tell us, who is this rebel group, the M23?
Well, the M23 is actually the reincarnation of a former rebel group called the CNDP. I think in order to explain, perhaps your listeners need to step back. The Congo, as you said, was in civil war or an international war waged on Congolese territory with nine African countries involved between 1996 and 2003. In 2003, there was a peace deal that unified the whole country and pacified it, largely speaking, except violence continued in the east. And the violence that's continued in the east since 2003 has sort of been incarnated in various different armed groups, and the M23 is sort of the latest reincarnation of those armed groups. And I think, just to give a very sort of simplistic and reductive explanation of why they've emerged, the peace deal that was concluded in 2003 between the various different armed groups in the Congo was very disadvantageous to the main armed group in the eastern Congo that was backed by the neighboring country of Rwanda. And since then, because that peace deal was disadvantageous to them, since then there have been numerous armed groups, all backed by Rwanda, that have emerged in the east, and the M23 is the latest of those.
Why did they, after taking Goma, why did they retreat? And, you know, what do they want from President Joseph Kabila?
Well, it's very difficult to say. What they say they want is initially they started off saying that they wanted simply these are former soldiers within the Congolese army, and they said that they wanted to have better salaries, better living conditions, better ranks. They had formerly been integrated into the Congolese army 3 years ago, and President Kabila had promised various things, and they said that he hadn't lived up to his promises. So they said all they wanted is for President Kabila to live up to his promises. But since then, things have taken on a much larger dimension, and now they're talking about government reform. They're talking about reforming the army. They're talking about the elections of last year. They say that they were deeply flawed. So their ambitions have become much larger, much wider, and go far beyond just the simple mutiny of army officers.
Their ambitions might be large and wide, but from your reporting and others, it doesn't seem as if their numbers are. I mean, they're able to take towns over and have this huge effect, but they number what, in the low few thousands?
Yeah, I think the important thing is their symbolic effect more than anything else. They started off with around 400 to 500 soldiers. That was in April. Now, most estimates put them probably at fewer than 2,000 soldiers. But this is where Rwanda really comes in. They have very close links to the Rwandan government, and extensive reporting has shown that the Rwandan government has backed them in every single important offensive. So even with the fall of Goma 2 weeks ago, the Rwandan government provided substantial military support. So they have enough soldiers to hold terrain, but in order to advance very far, they need support from the Rwandan government. So this is an armed group that has traumatized the Congolese population symbolically, but militarily they can't get very far without outside backing.
And you detail the relationship between them and Rwanda, but why are they allies? Is it an ethnic alliance?
Well, it's a long story.
As is everything,
indeed,
right?
The leadership... The military leadership of the group is from the ethnic Tutsi community, largely speaking at least. And this, of course, is also a community that is found in Rwanda, and many of the current leaders in Rwanda come from this community as well. So there are ethnic affinities, but I think largely speaking, this is a geopolitical matter. Rwanda has had a large sway and influence over the area in the eastern Congo since 1996. It feels that this area is within its sphere of influence and needs to stay within its sphere of influence. It has economic interests there, but also security threats that have come from there in the past. So it's a package of things that leads the Rwandan government to believe that the only way it can protect its interests, given the fact that it doesn't have any trust at all in the government in Kinshasa, is by maintaining a proxy in the eastern Congo.
Why are they called M23?
The peace deal that had integrated the predecessor of this group, which was called the CNDP, back in 2009, that peace deal was signed on March the 23rd, 2009. And when they mutinied in April this year, those mutineers said that Joseph Kabila had not implemented the March 23rd agreement, and that's why they were calling themselves the M23.
Right. So it's sort of like Black September, or naming a rebel group after an important date. It must be hard.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it must be hard to report and explain a conflict that perhaps the best explanation is there's no explanation, or at least no unified theory. Can you come as close as you can to, you know, give our listeners a sense of what are the notable aspects about this roiling conflict and the different sides, you know, to try to approach to get our heads around it?
You know, this is the curse of the Congo, really, is its complexity. And I bang my head against the wall every time a journalist asks me this question, because it's very difficult to summarize in 20 seconds. And, you know, if you mentioned previously before that 5 million people had died in the Congo, many, many people have indeed died in the Congo, but it's of a much different kind of killing than other conflicts, where there's an easily identifiable culprit and easily identifiable victims. Here, the lines are much more blurred. There's a lot of complexity. There's no one cause or one simple thing that drives the conflict. But not to avoid your question, I think we can boil it down to several things. First of all, the Congolese state has been undermined and hollowed out from within since the colonial era, really, but also in particular since the dictatorship of Mobutu Sese Seko for 32 years, backed by international powers, including the United States, really, you know, eroded Congolese institutions to the degree where the state is extremely weak, and it is very easy for armed groups to proliferate across the board, across the eastern Congo. The M23 is only one of several dozen different armed groups that exist in the eastern Congo. The second factor, I would say, is a regional one. In 1994, there was a genocide in Rwanda, and the perpetrators of the genocide, along with around a million other people, fled into this hollowed-out state, this security vacuum of the eastern Congo, which then prompted a Rwandan invasion. And that dynamic, that regional dynamic, where Rwanda feels like it needs to be involved in its neighbor, has continued, and as I explained, continues to fuel more and more armed groups, although it's not just a security threat anymore. There are economic interests and political interests as well. And then thirdly speaking, there are local conflicts at the very local level that have to do with basically local governance, land conflict over land, over justice, communal conflicts that pit customary chiefs and communities against each other, that have also been allowed to fester also because of this security and political vacuum that exists in the Congo.
Do you think it's solvable?
You know, I don't think there's a silver bullet here. I think, you know, this is where people have to roll up their sleeves and get involved in the difficult work of diplomacy. I don't think that another rebellion is going to solve the problems of the Congolese. I can tell you that. We've seen that movie before. We've seen that several times, and all it's brought is suffering and misery for the Congolese people. I think that there was a peace process that brought into power a democratic government with democratic institutions. It's an extremely weak and shambolic government that's deeply corrupt, that is at times abusive. But there is a dynamic going on in Congolese society where people believe, at least have, they know that there is a democratic way that's being charted forward. They have a new constitution. They have local elected assemblies. That was the path, and that took that image of a Congo very slowly and a very, you know, confronted with all these challenges coming together, that was dealt a very hard blow to this M23 rebellion. And this is why it's so tragic, not only because in terms of human lives, but because everybody, Congolese international community, have invested lives and billions of dollars in trying to create some sort of manageable political framework to move the country forward, and then comes along this rebellion and undermines a large part of that.
Does the United States do business with the current government of the Congo, or do United States companies have interests in the mineral gold and diamonds that are mined in the Congo?
There are companies across, there are companies from all over the place that invest in the region, including in Rwanda and the Congo. In the Congo, American companies do invest. Probably the largest is Freeport-McMoRan, which is one of the largest copper mining companies or mining companies in the world. It's based out of Arizona. They operate a very large copper mine in the south of the country. And there are other U.S. investments in U.S. businesses, private investments. And the U.S. government, I think, in terms of the government, invests almost $1 billion every year in terms of aid, humanitarian aid, feeding people, providing health care, but also to peacekeeping operations in the Congo. So I don't think that aid or engagement with the Congo is necessarily bad. Even on the private market, I don't think it's bad if it's done in a responsible, accountable fashion. But I think that the way the U.S. government in particular engages with the Congo does need to be done in a more transparent way. I mean, they have failed, I think, to leverage all of this aid that flows into the country every year, and donors in general, you know, supply a half of the Congolese government budget. They failed to leverage it to produce a more accountable, transparent government.
Yeah, so you say the United States, the West, gives $1 billion in aid to the Congo, but your point is it's not really going through the Congo, as in the people of the Congo. It's going to select pockets. You also write, and here's a quote, "The greatest sins of Western governments have been ones of omission and ignorance, not of direct exploitation. We simply have not cared enough." I'll stipulate that's certainly true, just in terms of how little it is in the news and how few people are aware of how bloody the conflict is. But what would caring enough or caring a lot look like? How much would United States interests or a motivated United States change things in that corner of the world?
Well, we've seen, you know, there was a peace process in the Congo between 1999 and 2006 with a lot of international involvement and with many flaws and failures, as I pointed out before. But there you saw, I think, extensive diplomatic engagement in the Congolese crisis, and you could say the deployment of a lot of political capital, not just financial capital. In general, our reaction to the catastrophe in the Congo has been to shower it with money. In other words, we send a lot of foreign aid. There's a lot of money that goes into the Congo. It's not for lack of money, but there's not a conventional amount of political capital. In other words, diplomats to go out there, engagement from the Secretary of State, engagement from the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa and other high-ranking officials, which is, after all, one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes in the world. More attention does need to be paid to it. So I said that, you know, they haven't been able to leverage the money to produce sort of commensurate political change. I think the U.S. government and other governments need to engage in a more frank fashion with the Congolese government and say, look, you know, if you're not willing to protect your people and provide your people with the security, with the infrastructure, with the development that they deserve, then we can't engage with you in this fashion. I'm convinced that if that kind of political, diplomatic capital were expended in the Congo, then I think we could get much further. And for that matter, I may add, in Rwanda as well. I mean, Rwanda is a very different story. It's done extremely well on development. It's done extremely well on social services provision, and yet it's been meddling consistently in its neighbor. And Rwanda, again, is a country where the U.S. government as well as U.S. private companies have a great deal of investment.
Well, that might not be a coincidence. You know, in U.S. foreign policy circles, especially among Democrats, there's a great deal of what's been called Rwanda guilt. Samantha Powers feels it. Susan Rice, who's, you know, recently been very much in the news, has said that she feels it. Former President Clinton says, you know, the greatest shame of his administration was not intervening more forcefully in Rwanda. Now that the Rwandan government has aligned with the M23, perhaps that Rwanda guilt is paralyzing the United States to some extent in terms of getting involved in the Congo, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's just a lack of nuance in terms of foreign policy. There is no doubt that Rwanda was let down by the international community, including the United States. There's no doubt that the United States government, as well as other governments, were complicit, as you could say, by the negligence in that, you know, cataclysmic event. 800,000 people were butchered in the space of 100 days. Absolutely. But that, again, does not justify the current ills and burn woes. I mean, you should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. You should be able to address internal problems in Rwanda, encourage them to move past those tragic horrors of the past, and at the same time have a responsible engagement in the region. The butchery of people in 1994 in Rwanda does not justify aggression in the Congo today. By no means does it justify aggression in the Congo today. And I think that is a message that U.S. diplomats have, for some reason, not been able to formulate, including the people that you have mentioned. I think the most recent example of this was when former President Bill Clinton visited Rwanda during the middle of the M23 uprising, and while many political people had already expressed their condemnation of Rwanda for its support to the M23 against the advice of the U.S. State Department. President Clinton went there to inaugurate a health center. And all he did while he was there was talk about 1994 genocide, but he didn't mention any of the current problems. So I think it's that sort of short-sightedness that has been a key flaw of U.S. foreign policy.
Jason Stearns is the author of the book Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa. He writes the widely read blog Congo Siasa. And I want to thank you. And in thanking you, could you tell us what Siasa means, Congo Siasa?
Siasa is Swahili for politics. So it just means Congolese politics.
Got it. Jason Stearns, thank you very much. And in a moment, John Brown and the raid that sparked the Civil War. There's a New York connection on this date. Stay tuned. Stick around.